Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for this Monday, August 27th. I'm Alan Chartok. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, an affiliate of Albany Med. Saratoga Hospital, with more than 20 locations across the greater Saratoga region. People you trust, care you deserve. SaratogaHospital.org. Joining us for Medical Monday is Dr. Paul Glavinsky of St. Peter's Sleep Center. Do you have trouble falling or staying asleep? Well, Dr. Glavinsky is just the person to help you out. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. He's got a new book out, and we're going to tell you all about it. Dr. Paul Glavinsky, your calls all coming up on your Vox Pop right after this news. Well, hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WNC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. We're very lucky today. Great favorite here, Dr. Paul Glavinsky, clinical director of St. Peter's Sleep Center in Albany, New York, is with us. Dr. Glavinsky is a clinical psychologist who's been working in the field of sleep disorders for more than 30 years. He's a fellow of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, co-authored two books and dozens of articles. His specialty is behavioral sleep medicine, with a focus on the treatment of insomnia and circadian rhythm disorders. He also practices in New York City. Okay, so, Doctor, you're getting sleepy. No, that's the name of your book. Tell us about it.
Well, it's a book that says, what do you bring to bed that gets in the way of your sleep? Uh-huh. So each chapter has a heading such as, are you too anxious to sleep? Are you too hyper to sleep? Are you out of sync to sleep? Are you too depressed? And then it tailors the recommendations based on those personality types or traits.
Well, let's take a couple of fast ones, that you just mentioned. Let's just say you're too anxious. You're an anxious person because you've got a lot to do in life. What do you do about that?
Right. Well, here's the problem. If you're an anxious person, oftentimes what happens after even weeks, let alone months or years, is the anxiety is about sleeping. People start to say, I used to have problems with such and such. I'm all good with that. But now I'm worried that I can't sleep because people get sensitized to it. And the thing about insomnia that's very frustrating is that if you think you're going to have insomnia, you will have insomnia.
Right.
So what we have to do is we have to reduce the variability, and we have ways to do this. So we're not after the big jackpot wonderful sleep anymore, which everybody is striving for. On the other hand, we don't get so many terrible, terrible nights. And we try to make sleep more boring and more predictable for this type. So there are ways that we can do that so that it's not a front burner issue all the time.
Okay, so let's say, because I have to be up by 3:30 every morning, it's now 1 o'clock. I'm afraid to go back to sleep because I won't wake up in time for 3:30, even though I know I have an alarm clock.
Right, right.
Right.
At that point, it does become difficult, and we know that when people have, say, a plane to catch, they wake up early, there's a hypervigilance that sets in. The best thing to do in that case, actually, when you're getting really anxious about sleeping, is not to try anymore, and that's where the recommendation to get out of bed, even though it seems like the last thing you want to do, the active ingredient is not trying to sleep anymore. So if you're just reading the magazine article in a chair, believe it or not, you can feel sleepy 15 minutes into that.
Yeah.
Whereas if you stay in bed, you'll see 1, 1:15, 1:30 a.m., no problem. You'll keep yourself up all the way to 3:30.
So I have a theory. Tell me why it's wrong. My theory is if you go to bed and say, okay, now I'm waiting for sleep to come, you cannot know when sleep is coming. I don't know if you're following me on this. You don't want to. Sleep comes, but not because you're willing it to come. It just comes on its own.
Absolutely. No, I'm with you on that. The metaphor I use is like a surfer catching a wave.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you have to paddle out, so to, you know, in the right position for sleep.
Sure.
But the wave of sleep catches you, and you can't go chasing after it. Otherwise, that'll never work.
Okay, so now I'm the rarest of all people. I already know this from you. I'm a tummy sleeper. And you've already told me that people either sleep on their back or their sides.
Most people, yeah.
Tummy is almost never, but I'm a tummy sleeper. So I've been reading all the books, and one of them says, stuff a pillow in, under your pajama, and then when you're, of course, I don't want to be on my, because, well, it's a long story, but I don't want to be a tummy sleeper anymore. I want to be a side sleeper. And then when you roll over on your stomach, the pillow will get in the way. But you also told me there's some variations on that theme.
Yeah, I mean, we've been using this for back sleepers because we try to keep some people off their back. We use a tennis ball, for example, sewn in a pocket in a pajama top. We've used the fanny packs that bicyclists have. We fill them with walnuts. Or you can go online, and there's probably 100 different positional devices, little shaped belts that you wear, and they keep you on one position or another.
What do you mean shape belts? I don't get that one.
Like a belt that you would strap around your waist,
yeah.
But it will have a little either protrusion so that if you're on your back, it's uncomfortable.
Uh-huh.
And therefore, it just sort of pushes you over to one side or the other.
And do you prescribe these things at the St. Peter's Sleep Center?
Well, you don't need a prescription for these.
But you tell people that's what you have to get.
Yeah. We can do it low-tech or high-tech, either one. But we sometimes, usually for apnea, try to keep people off their back because that may make it the apnea worse.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Now, is there a gender gap in terms of sexual activity in the middle of the night? I mean, a lot of men, right, go to sleep as soon as they're done with the sex act, whereas women sometimes stay up.
Certainly, that's what I've heard clinically. Again, I don't know if I can cite a study. That would be a hard study to do. But definitely, sex can be soporific or stimulating. And
I'm sorry, soporific is?
Bringing on sleep.
Okay, yeah.
Or stimulating and activating. So it can go either way.
Right. Okay. Let's go to Jim in Matamoros. Okay, Jim. Welcome back. Go ahead.
Just a comment today. It's very difficult for day sleepers to get a good night's sleep with all the telemarketers and other nuisances.
You're right.
Yeah, yeah. So you're a night shift worker and worked and sleep during the day.
Right? Yeah, more or less.
Yeah, that's true. A lot of times people come home from night shift and they can get 4 or 5 hours sleep. I don't know if that's your experience, but it's hard to get anywhere near 7 or 8 hours in the daytime for lots of reasons.
Is that circadian?
Partly it's that. It's partly that a lot of night shift workers don't fully adapt to night shift and day sleeping because they want to join the rest of the world on their days off. I don't know if that's your case, Jim.
Okay, thank you, Jim. Let's go to Monica in Ballston Spa. Monica, your turn.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. My question is about narcolepsy.
Mm-hmm.
So I was diagnosed with narcolepsy myself shortly before I started graduate school. And I was diagnosed at a sleep center. I think it was an EEG. It was within a couple hours. It wasn't a full overnight because I think it was so obvious. but anyway, I have a prescription for methylphenidate that I take, and I really now only need it when I'm driving long distances.
What that keeps you up?
Does it keep? No. It doesn't, and actually, I can drink all the coffee and have all the caffeine in the world. It does nothing. For me, it's really about I have to be stimulated in some way. So if I find like a great book on tape, if I forget my pills, I'll stop and I'll purchase a book on tape, and that'll work for me. You know, something
okay.
exciting like that.
Is there a question, Monica?
Yes, the question is that I'm seeing the same thing happening in my daughter now. I know it's you know, it's genetic. My dad and my aunt have narcolepsy. And so I'm seeing the same with my daughter now. I'm seeing that as soon as we start driving, she's falling asleep in class. So my question for the doctor is the diagnostic, are the tools the same? Would I be scheduling her for a sleep study? And then is the treatment the same?
Mm-hmm. How old is your daughter?
So she's 15 and a half.
15 and a half,
and,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, she's so, 15 and a half, and my concern is class, because that's mm-hmm. when I was taking it. I would take it, you know, at least once a day I would take it when I was going through, you know, going
right.
to class.
Well, Monica, let me just interject. So, you know, I'm not a medical doctor, so I'm not going to give you any specific advice about the methylphenidate. But in general, 15 and a half is a typical time if someone is going to develop narcolepsy for it to show. When I did my training long ago, it was thought that, you know, late adolescents, young adults, but now there's more and more work showing that there are signs of narcolepsy, even in children, and there have been work in 6-year-olds, 8-year-olds, and so on. It sounds like you have a family history. The simple
Absolutely.
Answer is it's generally at 15 and a half, it would be a similar set of studies. And it's not
right.
typically just an overnight study. It's often a series of 4 or 5 naps in the day called the multiple sleep latency test. Does that ring a bell for you? Did you have that test?
You know, honestly, it's funny because with me, it was done in Oregon years ago. And it was a question of whether they had me go all overnight. And then I was.
Hey, Monica, we got. I'm sorry, we got that out. I don't want to appear rude, but we have to take a break. We're up against the break.
It was only a couple hours.
It's these days it would be an overnight study and the series of naps, and that's what do it.
Yep.
Thank you, Monica.
Okay,
we're going to take a break, then we're going to come back and talk to Mark and Bob and Jesse. Just hold your horses. And we are back. Once again, we are back on the Vox Pop with our very special guest, Dr. Paul Glavinsky. Paul, I want you to tell everybody the name of your book one more time.
It's called You Are Getting Sleepy, Lifestyle-Based Solutions for Insomnia.
Yeah. And you did that with a partner, right?
Right. My late partner, a colleague 30 years or more, Dr. Arthur Spielman.
Uh-huh.
We wrote 2 books. This was the second one.
Well, that's great. Okay. So we're back to the phones. We have people on the phones hanging on. So let's go first in order of timeout. We'll go to Bob in Orange County. Bob.
Yes, hi. My question to the doctor is, can there be a case made for high school students to be coming to school later, let's say between 8 and 9 o'clock in the morning, rather than the typical 7:30, based on their natural
right.
rhythms of sleep?
Not only is there a case made, but there are states that are finally getting the message here. And this is a big initiative in public health. So absolutely, the later sleep hours of adolescents have a biological basis. And I'm explaining this to principals all the time. In general, all teenagers have that tendency, and then there are some people who have it much more extremely, and that's on a genetic basis as well. So yes, and in fact, there are school districts and people are thinking about this. Mary Karskadden is a name to look up. She's, you know, spearheading an initiative in this direction.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mark. Appreciate that. Bob. Yes, that was Bob. Okay. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. And now on to Jesse in Troy. All right, Jesse, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a quick question. I am very sensitive to sound when I sleep.
Right.
And I wear earplugs as a result. It's very easy if I hear an abrupt sound to, like, shock me awake. So every night I wear earplugs. I'm just wondering if there's any kind of physiological reason not to do that, or if I'm kind of good to go as long as it's working for me.
Yeah, a lot of people do wear earplugs. Not a problem. Another thing that people find helpful is to use a white noise generator.
Mm.
A fan will do, but you can also go fancy and get, you know, rain on the roof and ocean waves and so on. But the idea
is that wouldn't work with my wife, though.
Yeah. That will mask the more abrupt sounds and put a background against it, and that can be helpful.
Now, how about your Freudian upbringing? I mean, for example, me. I grew up on 96th Street in New York, It was where the crosstown bus switched into second gear, and fire trucks all the time and everything like that. Now, there are other people that would drive crazy. But when we go back to New York and sleeping in New York, I think I'm home again. It's so lovely to hear all of those sounds. Puts me right to sleep. What do you think?
No, well, there have been studies also of people who live by airports, and they, you know, they do acclimate. The brain is always registering when there's a sound. We can see something like a K-complex, certain brain waves that can be elicited. So it's not as if we don't register the sound, but the kind of noise that would completely destroy sleep, you know, 1 week can oftentimes be dealt with even, you know, weeks or months later.
That's so interesting, because in Great Barrier, we got a train that comes through three or four times a night, maybe two or three, and it makes a lot of noise. And there are lots of houses, including some fancy houses, right on the railroad tracks. And you wonder, how do they get through that?
Right.
But they find a way.
Probably acclimate. But some people, such as our caller, are more sensitive.
Jesse, thanks. Okay, and then sleep masks are another story. My marriage was saved by sleep masks because my wife likes to read, and she would come to bed much later than me, you see? But once we discovered a sleep mask, all was solved.
There you go. So these are easy fixes.
There you go. And now on to Mark in Salem. All right, Mark, your turn.
Hello, Alan. Hello, Doctor.
Hi.
I'm a person who has studied the 18th and early 19th century, and I have a comment and then a question. The comment is that the people in the 18th century tended to sleep in a slightly raised position on the upper part of their body. That's why the beds were so short. It wasn't because they were short. It was because they slept more, not sitting up, but lying more like on a chaise lounge or something. And I always thought that was just because they were shorter, but then I found out from my reading. And the second thing I would mention about, they had Benjamin Franklin was a big believer in this, that they had two periods of sleep. They would go to bed at a fairly early hour, 8 o'clock or when it got dark, and they would sleep till like midnight, and then they would get up, and they'd actually go outside sometimes and greet their neighbors, have something to eat, use the outdoor facilities, and then they would have what they called dead sleep, which would be after that, and so they'd have another four-hour period. Is that something that you are familiar with or have any experience with?
So first and second sleep, or and this has been commented on, and I think the feeling in the field now is that this was sort of a cultural phenomenon of that time in Western Europe. There was a question as to whether it was more reflective of how people slept in general before, you know, the modern age, but there were some really ingenious experiments or observations done by researcher Jerry Siegel. He was studying indigenous peoples in Africa and South America with active watches, and lo and behold, these people who are one of the tribes didn't even have huts; they slept out on blankets. All three tribes had 7.5 hours of sleep on average in a one period, kind of like modern society. So it seems like this Western Europe first and second sleep was more of an anomaly.
Yeah.
Because I find that more restful. I find myself getting up like at 1 a.m. and coming downstairs and having a little tiny bite to eat and getting back in bed, and then I go into my deep sleep.
Right.
And it's just
That could work. And I would just mention that the thought now is that if you get, say, 3 hours of good sleep, have a break, and get, say, 4 hours of good sleep, that's pretty much equal to 7 hours. It's the quality of each minute of sleep that can be problematic. If the sleep's not of good quality, it doesn't add up.
Mark, thank you. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. If you want to be on the radio with Dr. Klavinsky, this is the time to do it. You'll get on. And we'll go to Judy in Beacon. Judy in Beacon, you're on.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can.
Hi. So, only because I have my situation is that when I hit menopause, I had a very hard time sleeping. So, I mean, and like most nights. And then I started meditating, and that helped me a great deal. But I still have problems on Sunday nights, and I feel very tired, and I don't feel like there are things on my mind. And yet, I can't sleep on Sunday nights. Sometimes I go through the entire night without a wink of sleep, which makes the week very difficult. Any thoughts?
Well, so you're a psychologist, and that's very interesting to me because I think this is something that I keep meeting people who say Sunday nights are very, very difficult.
Right.
In my case, it was coming back from Fire Island after the weekend and deciding whether to do my homework or to watch Maverick. And so, you know, that I think that guilt is held on for my entire life.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Right. Well, two things to say up front about Sunday nights. People who have a work week starting Monday morning, that's, you know, a fairly clear reason why you'd be more agitated, even if you're not expressly thinking about some assignment the next day. The other thing that happens for most people, because our circadian clocks like to keep us up later, and there's also a lot of socializing that goes on in the weekend, is that we tend to drift later in the timing of our sleep on Friday night and Saturday night. And our internal clocks love that direction, so they would like to stay there. And then all of a sudden on Sunday night, you have to pull back and go to sleep because you have to be up early the next day. And that could be a special problem. So those two things are at work.
That's true. Well, thank you. Appreciate that, Judy. Okay. And 1-800-348-2551. And now to Dave in Ulster County. Hi, Dave.
Hey, folks. How you doing?
Hi.
So far, so good. Don't ruin it.
I will not do that. I've got a great question for you guys, and I ask myself this all the time. I go to sleep, and I dream every night, and I constantly dream every night. Sometimes I remember the dream, sometimes I don't. Does that mean I'm in deep sleep or I am not fully asleep?
Well, it means most likely that you have a lot of REM sleep. REM sleep is where we have the movie-like dreams.
Is that good?
Absolutely. We need REM sleep and non-REM sleep. Those are the two big divisions. And there's thinking that goes along in each. But when you have a movie going on in your head, you're in REM sleep. And REM sleep happens about 4 or 5 times a night for almost everyone.
Really?
Not that we remember all the dreams. You know, you become sensitized and do remember them. But there's absolutely nothing wrong. In fact, that's where you're kind of making sense of your experience and getting to the gist of problems. And it's a time for creativity. And, you know, you would do worse without it. So the dreams are a good thing.
So I would assume then by what you're saying that this is quality sleep.
It's quality in it's not deep in the sense of the non-REM deep stages, because the brain is actually active and it looks like on the EEG that it's awake, but it's absolutely of important quality to lots of things, mainly our brain and our cognitive and emotional functioning. So absolutely, it's good sleep.
Thank you, Dave. Okay. 1-800-348-2551. And now over to Evelyn in Saratoga Springs. Okay, Evelyn, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My problem is this. I think I do have true insomnia, but sometimes I can get to sleep, you know, but then, like, say after 2 hours, 3 hours, I'll wake up very tense, very cold, and then I can't get back to sleep again.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered.
Yeah, well, that's certainly a type of insomnia. So there are basically three kinds. There's difficulty falling asleep, difficulty staying asleep, and then just non-restorative sleep, even when people sleep.
I have the first two.
difficulty staying and getting to sleep.
Right. Sometimes I do have difficulty.
Yeah. Well, you are not alone. I mean, we're talking about millions and millions of people, and there are wonderful cognitive behavioral treatments. There are sleep centers nearby. You know, St. Peter's is not too far from you, and there are certainly others as well. So the good news is that we've been studying this now for decades, and there are some effective non-drug treatments. Sometimes we use medication, but we really try for the long term to work with non-pharmacologic treatments.
Evelyn said something that I found very interesting about waking up and being cold.
Mm-hmm.
I wake up and I'm hot.
Yeah. Well, that's important. So normally we sleep well when we're cooling.
Right.
We're generating heat during the day. And when we go to sleep, our body temperature is actually pretty high, but it's falling. And
right.
As long as it's falling, we sleep well. And then as it's rising again, we wake up. But some people have difficulty regulating temperature. Evelyn, it sounds like you may be one of them. And that has a direct link to the quality of sleep.
But I thought you were commending. I thought you were commending Evelyn. In other words, that her body was cooling, which is what it's supposed to be.
Right,
where my body is warming.
Right, but it's a matter of degree. There's what's called a thermoneutral zone. That's where you're comfortable, and she's evidently mm-hmm. out of it. So she's like overshooting, and she may be cooling too much. So,
why does one me wake up?
Yeah, what do you do?
Sweating.
Well. You know, we're doing research even at St. Peter's. We're doing this. I can give you some hints. I don't have a clear, wrap it up. But basically, it turns out that we get rid of the heat in our body in an interesting way. It flows through our bloodstream to our fingers and toes.
Uh-huh.
And some people who have vasoconstriction, so they have cold hands and feet at other times, especially in the winter, they can have difficulty sleeping because they can't get the heat to leave the body. Alan, you may have that issue, waking up warm, so you're retaining the heat. But in general, we have to be within a 1 degree Celsius range. Otherwise, too hot, too cold. Either way, it's not going to work for sleep.
Okay. Evelyn, thank you. Appreciate that. All right, 1-800-348-2551. And now we're going over to Jamie in Albany. Okay, Jamie is on the phone. Jamie, you got a couple of seconds here. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Doc. I have a twofold question. First, I just recently started taking vitamins, and I take like about 3 of them. So, and I take them at night because they said they stay in your system better. I've been having a hard time sleep since I started taking those vitamins. So now when I'm tired in the morning and I drink tea during the morning so I can stay up. And then I was wondering if the vitamins has an effect and how long does tea stay in your system to keep you from sleeping?
Yeah. Well, okay. The vitamins, I don't have a lot to say because each is different and people react differently. But let me talk about the tea and caffeine because that's a very important. So the answer is, it takes between 5 and 7 hours
Whoa.
For half of the caffeine in the tea to leave your body,
Uh-oh.
Or coffee, or Uh-oh. Energy drinks, or however you get the caffeine. And people have no idea that it takes that long. So even after we call these half lives, it could be 10 or 14 hours later, the cup of tea or coffee is still working against your sleep. So you have to be very careful. Some people are very sensitive.
Well, as the old joke goes, Jamie, don't scratch. Thanks very much, Jamie. 1-800-348-2551. We have time. No, I'll tell you what. We'll take a break, and then we'll come back so we'll have more time on the third segment, and then we'll talk to Leslie and Marie and Katie and Benno and Dave. Go. Well, we're back. That's wonderful. It's always wonderful to be surprised. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Always great. Okay, so now let's go. I'm looking at the numbers here to Marie in Orange County. Okay, Marie, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wondered if the doctor could comment on the brainwaves involved with sleeping. About 10 years ago, I found a program that I listen to. I have earbuds that I put in and my iPod, and I start this program, and it's effective in helping to stimulate the brainwaves for deep sleep. Can you comment on that and what brainwaves? I think it's delta brainwaves.
Yeah. So there is work being done on this. I don't know exactly, you know, what you have there, but people are looking at ways to sort of kindle brainwaves, and it would be delta. So as we sleep, the general direction is the brainwaves slow up. When we're thinking and we're active, our brainwaves are fast, and they're not very high. Their amplitude is not very high. And as we fall asleep, our brain waves slow, and it becomes at the deepest part, which is a deep slow wave sleep, big rolling waves like ocean breakers. And probably if some of the programs are trying to kind of bring the brain around to making those kind of waves, other people say that just listening, say, to a podcast or anything that's on a very low volume can distract. And there I think it's more a question of being distracted from your own life. Basically, get away from your own issues, you know, financial issues, work issues, whatever. Be in somebody else's experience for the last 15 or 20 minutes. And that that gives your brain the opening that it needs to fall asleep.
Great question, Marie. Thank you. You know, my wife is one of those people. She turns on the BBC early in the morning. Whether she's bored, whether it bores her to death or not, she sleeps well with that.
Right. Yeah. It's mainly not thinking about your own thoughts.
Yeah, absolutely true. So now we're going to go to Leslie in Albany, who's been holding on for a while. Go ahead, Leslie.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have a six-year-old who cannot fall asleep at night. We have very good sleep hygiene. We have a very regular schedule, same time every night, but it can take her up to 3 hours to fall asleep at night.
And the question is?
A doctor.
Yeah, go ahead.
Right?
Go ahead.
The doctor has told us to give her melatonin, 1 milligram of melatonin, half an hour before bedtime. But I'm just wondering about the long-term effects of melatonin in children.
Yeah, good question. The short answer is we don't know. It's very common for people of all ages to use melatonin because it comes from a health food store without prescription. The conversation in the field these days is, why is melatonin the only hormone around that we say, here, take it forever, and, you know, we don't have to hear about it? You know, you would never give any other hormone like that. Mm. And so the thought is, hey, wait, let's hold off. We do use melatonin. It's been used for decades. I use it in my practice, even with kids sometimes, in different ways. It's a little too complicated to explain here. The operative word is short term, and, you know, have an exit strategy.
Okay, Leslie, thank you. All right, now let's go to Katie in the Berkshires. Katie in the Berkshires, you're on.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, good.
So I wanted to follow up on a previous caller, the gentleman who was talking about the consistent dreaming. I have every night, I have very, very vivid dreams, which, like you said, means I'm probably in the REM sleep. Mm-hmm. But my thing is I wake up seemingly after each dream. So I'm waking up from, like, you know, 6 to 8 times a night. Mm. And I'm wondering how that affects my overall sleep.
Well, at a certain point, it does begin to fragment sleep. There are lots of reasons that can happen. It can be the dream content. It can be the fact that REM is actually an active state. It's pretty close in terms of brainwaves to wakening. It's not uncommon to have a short awakening after REM. We were talking about temperature regulation. We lose our ability to regulate temperature in REM, and that can cause people to wake up. So again, on this show, it's hard to know exactly why, but I should add also sleep disordered breathing is worse in REM. So a lot of times people will wake up each REM cycle because they have more difficulty. And I'm not saying any one of those is yours, but I'm just pointing out it's a complicated problem. You know, that's maybe something that you could check with a sleep center if it's a problem for you.
Right, and I do feel like I need quite a bit of sleep. I feel like for a lot of my life, I need at least 9 hours a night to really feel functional.
Mm-hmm. How old are you?
I'm 29.
Yeah, so you're at the top of the normal range. It's absolutely possible you do need, and a lot more people probably need 8 or 9 and they don't get it. So if you need nine, you know, you should get nine. And we get worried when that number is 11, 12, 13. And, you know, I see people at the sleep center with hypersomnia. You're not in that range. That's the top of the normal range.
Thank you, Katie. Okay, we're moving right along so we can get everybody in. And now to my very good friend, Benno in Sheffield, Massachusetts. Hi, Benno.
Hey, how are y'all? So I had a broken neck and was quadriplegic for a short period of time, recovered for a long period of time in a hospital where every 2 hours a team came in and rolled me over because I couldn't move on my own. Mm-hmm. And so I have ever since that time only slept in 2 hour segments. No matter what I do, no matter what drugs I take to try and overcome it, have consequently felt like I haven't had a decent night's sleep in 8 years since the accident. Mm. So wondered, but I have not gone to a sleep center to have that further studied, but thought you might have a comment or two on it.
Mm-hmm. Do you have residual pain or some kind of discomfort based on what happened then?
Oh, yes. I'm on pain medication, and I have pain 24/7.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's much more likely than the fact that the routine 8 years ago involved the 2 hours. I understand that it's the same interval, but ongoing pain now and the pain medication, which saps wakefulness, because you see, to sleep well during the night, you have to have a certain kind of activation during the day, and pain medication is sort of a side effect, as you well know, sort of blunts that activation, and it can make you actually sleepy. So I think those are the issues. It's difficult because, you know, we're working with this chronic condition. There are behavioral things that can be done. And the idea would be to get good quality sleep, even if it comes in segments. OK, earlier on, I said that you can add up, you know, if you get good quality, you can add up hours here with hours there and end up with sleep that's going to be restorative.
Mm-hmm. OK, and, you know, I'm not sure that you're. Hypothesis is accurate because I will look at the clock after each time I wake, mm-hmm. and inevitably it is within 10 minutes of 2 hours either way each time. And some nights it's exactly 2 hours, every mm-hmm. 2 hours. So it's not just sort of that general okay. sense of, anyway, I don't want to take up too much
How long does it take to fall back asleep after that you wake up?
I can
up?
Do that very quickly.
Right. So what I'm saying is that you actually, although it may be distressing in one way, you could actually get a reasonable night that way. When we have somebody with a sleep disorder such as sleep apnea, they can be waking 100 times a night, you see. If you get a good stretch, you wake up, you get another good stretch, and so on, you may be getting a good night's sleep. And it could be, for example, that if you use sleeping pills to remedy that, you're doing more harm than good.
Benno, thank you for your call. You know, it's very interesting because if you've ever been in a hospital, some people have, the nursing staff comes in and wakes you up all night long.
Mm-hmm.
I've often wondered whether that's a good idea.
Right. No, and a lot of people are thinking about that, and they are starting to design quiet rooms and quiet staffing and
sure.
realizing that sleep is a key medicine, and they withhold it from the patient.
Right. Okay, let's go to Teresa in Stillwater. Teresa in Stillwater, you're on.
Yes, sir. I'm calling for my husband, who has had a sleep problem for about 3 years. He's been on a variety of medication, but he has been on mirtazapine for a while. He's been cutting it down with the approval of the doctor. He's down to a quarter of a pill. He wants to get off these pills so bad. And once he's down to a quarter of a pill, that seems to be as far as he can go. Then he'll have to go back up to a half a pill. Is it possible to get off of this sleep medication?
It is possible. Obviously, it has to be done in conjunction with the prescribing doctor, right? So that's number one. Mirtazapine and other such drugs stay in the bloodstream. They're not exactly the same as typical sleeping pills that clear. So they generally can be tapered gradually because the blood levels can be brought down slowly. So absolutely, people do get off these drugs, and I mean, it's something to discuss with your husband's doctor. It can be done, often in conjunction with behavioral interventions. You have to do something else to strengthen sleep while you're removing a medicine that was helping get to sleep.
Thank you, Teresa. Okay, and now on to Melanie in Utica. Melanie in Utica, you're on.
Thanks for taking my call. My question is regarding teeth grinding during sleep.
Welcome to the club.
Cause and treatment.
Yeah, I mean, there are some people who have just long histories of this. It can be hyperarousal, agitation. There's sometimes a family history. As far as I know, it's still mouth guards. You wouldn't want to take typically a medicine for something that's really, it's a chronic, as you know, condition. It can get better or worse. So the key thing is to keep the teeth healthy, and that's where the dentist makes the mouth guard. Relaxation training.
And money. Makes the mouth guard and money.
Right. Relaxation training. What I would say, and I try this with patients at the sleep center, the real key is what happens in the hours before you go to bed. What's the state that you're going to sleep? And this is the case for something like bruxism, as you or other kinds of behaviors in sleep. Sleep is not relaxing. That's the interesting thing. You can still be agitated in sleep. If we put leads on your muscles, we can see them very tense in sleep. If we have them on the jaw, we see that bruxism, the teeth gnashing in sleep. You have to relax while you're still awake. So really make an effort in the last hour or two before you go to bed. See how that works.
Thank you, Melanie. Okay, I'll go to Donna in Avril Park. Donna in Avril Park, you're on.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I never had a problem going to sleep when I was working. I could drink two cups of tea and still go to sleep at 11:30 and never had a problem. But I was always up, you know, by 7 in the morning, and I was tired. I hated getting up at 7. So I swore when I retired I wouldn't get up early. Well, now the problem is I cannot go to sleep before 1 or 2, and then I'm getting up later in the morning. So I want to know if I force myself to get up, even if I'm tired, if I can modify my sleep pattern.
Absolutely. Usually anyone who slept well for decades, say during your work life, can sleep well again. What happened is this: we have an internal clock that times our sleep, and for almost all of us, it runs a little slow. It likes a longer day than 24 hours, so our sleep tends to drift later.
Interesting.
When you were working, your alarm clock on Monday through Friday kept you in check. You don't have it, and it's drifted. What I would say, though, don't do it all at once. Just back up a half an hour in your wake-up time and get used to that for a while, you know, a week, 2 weeks, whatever, before you back up your wake time again a half hour. Don't go to sleep early without getting up early. You can't force yourself to sleep at all. You can lie in bed, look at the ceiling if you do that. But on the other hand, in the morning, if it's within reason, you can get up a little bit earlier, let's say 15 or 30 minutes earlier consistently. That would help.
Thank you, Donna. Okay, let's now go. I'm trying to get everybody in. You will recognize that. Let's go to Barry in Aylesbury, Vermont. Barry, you're on.
Thank you. I have a question about sleeping with a light on at night. For years, I've not been able to sleep. I have neurological Lyme disease. Seems like I can't turn off the brain. I finally found that gabapentin taken when I go to bed usually gets me sleepy in about 15 minutes, but it's so quick I don't get a chance to turn off the light until I wake up later in the night, maybe around 2 o'clock or so, turn off the light and then go back to sleep. But sleeping those hours with the light on, is that not getting decent sleep, or is that okay?
It's a regular overhead light?
It's a bedside lamp right beside
me. Yeah. Well, in general, light is not okay during the night. It's a big problem. In general, I mean, the simplest thing is they sell timers. Just put it on a timer and you know, set it for 20 minutes. It'll be off and you're good to go. The light goes through your eyelids. We're aware of the light, you know, even if your eyes are closed. And we're just not, we didn't evolve under lights like that. We shouldn't have it during the night.
Okay, thank you very much. All right, now over to John in Cooperstown. All right, John in Cooperstown, your turn.
Hello?
Hello, yeah. John. It's got to be fast. We're running out of time. Go ahead.
Hi. Okay, so my question, can you hear me?
Yeah. Yes.
All right, my question involves putting in, picking out light fixtures. I work for a small construction company, and we often put in LED light fixtures, recessed lights. And I've heard a little bit about some concerns about certain colors of light with LED lights being disruptive to our natural sleep cycle. And I wondered if you had any opinion about how serious a concern this is and if there's anything in particular we should be looking for with our LED lights.
Sure.
To be less disturbing to sleep. You know, they're really nice because they're energy efficient, but if it matters in the bedroom or anywhere in the house.
Okay, we're going to get you an answer or we'll run out of time.
Yeah. So, John, the quick answer is the companies are working on it. The color of the light, in terms of what color white light it is, makes a big difference. The companies have come up with sleep lights that do not have the blue part of the spectrum, even in LED. And those are better, you know, in the bedroom. And then for task lighting, where people want to be activated and, you know, extra awake, they use the blue rich white light. So there's a big literature on that. And you can find LEDs that have those different wavelength characteristics.
Thank you, John. Okay, now we have a couple of emails. Very quickly, they're going to take one second answers. Ready? I'm 72 years old, but sleeping on my tummy my whole life is, except when pregnant, is there something wrong with this?
No. If you could sleep well on the tummy, that's fine.
Okay, and I once read that if I just lay quietly in bed, you're getting about 80% of your rest. That's a false, right?
That's a false.
Yeah, thank you very much for that.
That's
one.
Easy.
And then we heard from Mark. For those of us who must work changing shifts, or for anyone who needs to change the time they got to sleep and wake up, what's the best way to do this? We need it real fast.
Yeah, anchor sleep. Try to get the same 4 hours at least every night or day. If you can get 4 hours that are the same, you'll do a lot better.
And we are out of time. Thanks, everybody who called in. Support for the Medical Monday comes from WMC Heart and Vascular Institute with new diagnostic cardiology suites at Mid-Hudson Regional Hospital and Health Alliance Hospitals, members of the Westchester Medical Center Health Network, WMCHealth.org. Thanks, everybody, for joining us today on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Jordan Taylor. Your calls were answered by Joe Makowitz. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis, and I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update. Thank you so much, Doctor.
Thank you.